I'm Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll welcome back TV and film writer Drew Chapman, whose latest novel is a sequel to The Ascendant, titled The King of Fear. Stick around. The new book is the story of a world-class sociopath not running for public office. Don't you just hate when you become totally engrossed in a thriller or a mystery novel and then it just ends? I always want to scream, "No!" and beg the author to make it go on a little longer. Now, that's probably the lure of stories with continuing characters, whether it's Harry Potter or Harry Bosch. We get to know them, their characteristics, good and bad, their inflection points, their weaknesses, and much more. And once we inhabit their world, from a safe distance, of course, we never want to leave. I felt that way about Drew Chapman's first novel, The Ascendant, which introduced us to a certified genius, Garrett Riley, a man who sees patterns in places the rest of us simply don't see anything at all. He puts his talents to work in the financial markets, but soon finds himself wrapped up in international intrigue and government conspiracy theories. When that book was done, I wanted more Riley, and I told Chapman as much. Well, I'm thrilled to report that Chapman is back with more mind-numbing and terrifying Riley adventures in The King of Fear, which I made the mistake of taking on a business trip to London and then couldn't put it down until I reached the end of the book. Thank you, and damn you, Drew.
And I like the mind-numbing part.
Well, you know, and with that, Drew Chapman, welcome back to Mr. Media.
No, thank you for having me.
Good to have you. Good to see you. And let's start at the end. There will be more Garrett Riley stories, won't there?
There will absolutely be more Garrett Riley stories. I'm working on one right now. I'm doing a certain amount of television stuff at the same time, so it's a little... I'm not the perfect thriller novelist, right? The guy who cranks one out every year. It's like I have to sort of split my time a little bit between that and television. So, yeah. So every other year. That's about as good as I can do.
All right, that's good. And we'll talk about what you're doing with TV in a little bit. But
sure.
I'm really glad to hear that to be another one because, yeah, I don't know what it is about this guy. He's got a lot of faults, and I think maybe that's part of it is, you know, he's so imperfect that you get wrapped up in him.
You know, that was the whole point. The whole point of the books was, like, this really flawed main character. I just, you know, and I wanted him to have flaws that weren't the sort of the usual flaws, like, you know, I've killed too many people. I'm sad about that. It's like, oh, yeah, that guy. It's like, oh. Every time I pick up a thriller novel, it's like, I'm so sad about the number of people that I've killed, or I don't care about the number of people I killed. Well, Garrett Riley's never killed anybody, and I'm hoping that he won't actually ever kill anybody. You know, that's the whole point. He sort of thinks his way out of problems.
Mm. Comes close a few times.
He does come close a few times, and that's, you know, he pushes the envelope. But, you know, to actually kill someone is, I don't know, that's a pretty big deal. And it's not like I want to make the stories tiny, but I did want to, you know, they are more of, like, character studies. I mean, to me, when I write, it doesn't matter whether I'm writing television, a book, whatever, it's like what you're really doing is you're writing a character study, and then you're putting a lot of really interesting plot around that character study. And that, to me, those are the best books. Like, those are the books that are really, like, they're so absorbing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wasn't going to ask you this, but who do you like to read? Who's inspired you to think like that?
Well, of the modern guys, I do have to say that I love Lee Child. I like the Jack Reacher books, but I don't like all of them. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like, he's a guy who perhaps maybe shouldn't write one every single year. Like, he could take a year off, you know, every other year would probably be fine. So I love his books. I don't know if you've ever read Alan First. Do you know who he is?
I know Stephen First, his cousin. No, I'm just kidding.
Stephen, you went to his bar mitzvah. Alan First he writes these mystery thrillers set in wartime Paris, World War II Paris. He's American. And they're called the Night Soldier series. And it's the Nazis are running Paris, and the Nazis are running most of Europe, and it's all about these guys trying to, like, work spy thriller stuff under Nazi control, and they're just so atmospheric. They're wonderful. I really love those. Hmm. Those are the two guys I read. I'm, you know, because I'm doing a lot of spy stuff on television, I'm always rereading John le Carré, because he's the greatest ever. Like, he's just a spectacular writer and a spectacular spy mystery thriller guy. So he's the king.
Do you worry about absorbing too much from other books?
No, not really. I wish I had time to read more. I wish I could absorb more stuff and watch more television shows. And there are so many books and there are so many TV shows. Like, there's not enough hours in the day. Like, I don't know how when people tell me they've, you know, binged watched all these shows and then they've read every single Jack Reacher novel. I'm like, and what? How do you make money? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah, I get that. We've been watching a lot of TV lately around here, and I don't know. You know, every time my wife comes upon a series that she thinks she wants to watch in its entirety, she says, "Well, we should just sit down and watch it." I'm like, where do you think we have the time to do that?
Exactly. Mean, who's going to pay the mortgage?
We encountered one recently called Dark Matter. It was a sci-fi series. It turned out it was terrific, and the funny thing about it was that it was on Sci-Fi, and we watched it on Netflix after it had run. But the thing about it was it took so much from every other sci-fi show you'd ever seen. Part of the fun of it was to pick up, okay, that came from Star Trek, or no, that came from Star Wars.
The little references.
Yeah. But we watched two or three at a clip, but it still took us weeks to get through. I mean, I just don't know how people do that.
I don't either. And when you go into it's one thing for television. The other thing is I walk into a bookstore and I'm like, okay, I could spend $1,000 easily on books I will never read. Right. I mean, they would just stack up by my bedside table. And I have a friend who works for Amazon. So he's always, you know, and Amazon gets every book ever published as he works in the book review section. So they want him to review books, so he has, I mean, literally room upon room of new books that he's just giving away. He's like, here, take a couple of these books, take a couple. And so then I have room upon room of new books, and, you know, they're great, but you can't do it. It's such a big world, and there's so many damn people in it. It's like, well, everybody has a story.
When I work on I make my living writing nonfiction, and, you know, when I start talking to someone about a book, they want to hire me to write their book or something. They talk about, oh, it's going to be great. It'll be so popular. And I just say, have you ever been in a bookstore? do you know that you couldn't read all of this week's books, let alone everything in a single section? And you're going to compete with all those books.
And this is such an interesting topic because for me, as somebody who writes a very specific, you know, genre like thrillers with this very specific character, the only way to really have longevity, to keep doing it, to, you know, make a living and is to write something where you have very specific fans, right, who just want to read your books as they come out. I mean, I wish I could write one book a year. I think it would do me a lot of good. People want that. They want to read one a year, and they want, you know, now comes the next Drew Chapman book. I'll read that. Here's the next Lee Child book. I'll read that, you know. But it's just hard to do. Yeah. It's hard to do. But you do. I think the world of entertainment now requires fans, and the way that it didn't require in the past. People could browse a book. You know, there weren't quite so many offerings in all different types of entertainment. And now it's just, it's vast. It's a vast marketplace.
Oh, it's so fragmented. I mean, whether it's books or TV or film, I mean, some of the best writing is going on in your main line of work, in TV and books. There's so much good stuff. This is your second book now, so maybe it's too soon. I don't want to plant this in your head, but do you ever feel intimidated by the sheer number of writers that you're competing with in the marketplace? Now I do, Bob. Thanks
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, really, totally. Let me go.
Thanks for screwing me up. Yeah, right.
No, I don't, because I don't compare myself to them. Like, I think that the guys who are really good, like, you know, John le Carré or Alan First, those guys are just spectacular, and I couldn't, like, I'll never be the writers that they are. And the guys who aren't, I'm better than them right from the word the. Like, those guys are terrible, and no names mentioned. But there are sometimes I look at, like, these series of books, and I'm like, did you even think about, like, what you were doing when you wrote this? I mean, you're just free associating on the page, and you're famous because you've written, like, 40 of these books, but they're just ghastly. So, I don't know. I will say I do get intimidated. I get more intimidated in the world of TV writing than I do in novels. And maybe that's just because I'm newer at the novel game. Mm. But, like, I was being interviewed to write on the show Homeland as a staff writer. And I'm still up for the job. I don't think I'm going to get it. But I have to say, like, that was intimidating. Like, the people who write for Homeland are really good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that I consider that to be a great show. And I was nervous. I told them, I'm like, look, I'll be honest with you. I'd love to work on this show, but I don't know that I can match your level of how great you guys are. So
maybe you should read one of your books.
Didn't get me the job. What?
You should read one of your books, because I think it holds up against anything I've seen in Homeland, and I've seen all of Homeland.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very sweet of you.
Well,
I don't actually feel that way, but I'm not being disingenuous. I really think that Homeland's great. Like, I actually think Homeland to me is sort of the gold standard of books or of television, of, like, really good spy stuff. Especially, did you watch the last season?
Oh, yeah. It was excellent.
That was the best season yet.
I agree.
That was spectacular.
I agree.
So complicated and detailed and emotional and just, like, you felt really grounded and real in a way that past seasons have not felt so grounded and real.
Well, it was very – and the reason I think that you'd be great for that show is that I think a lot of what goes on in that show happens up here. I mean,
yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you – I'm going to ask you in a second about Riley is getting back into his head, because – his head is a mess, but, you know, it's like Carrie Matheson's head is – a lot of the action is what's going on in her head, and we don't always know what it is, but sometimes there's a sudden twist happens because she's off her meds, or, you know, she thinks so differently than anyone else, and, I mean, that's Garrett Riley's MO.
Absolutely, and I definitely – I'm not going to say I stole from Homeland, but I looked to Homeland for inspiration, for character inspiration, and plot inspiration, how they go about telling the stories. Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I have to be careful of when I'm writing the Garrett Riley books is to not be too much in the heads of the characters and to allow real plot to happen. I think that, you know, that's a danger zone for you know, I mean, look, let's be honest. These are genre books, right? These are thrillers. You want to be, you know, compelled to turn the pages and just be zipping along. And if it's too internal monologue, then, you know, you can get bogged down in that. So I when I reread and when I edit, and I do a lot of editing, I think about that. I'm like, okay, does this need to be an interior monologue? Does the reader really need that? Or can we just move on to the next thing that's going to happen? And see it as opposed to, you know, have it play out as plot as opposed to thoughts. Hmm. So I'm always aware of that. Always, always, always. I think that there are some books where it's just too much. You know, there's too much going on inside the heads of the characters. Sometimes it's wonderful, but sometimes it's slow. And also, this is my personal predilection. You know, I'm a very mainstream guy. I like stuff that kind of, like, just gets going.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get too intellectual for me, I take a nap.
Well, I mean, there's no issue with – I mean, I want this to come out right, but, I mean, The King of Fear, there's no downtime in reading this book. It moves very, very rapidly.
It's not Carl Ove Nausgaard, My Struggle for Novels of Norwegian Internal Monologue. No.
There
it is
go.
Not.
No.
It never will be.
No, no. But at the same time, the reason I'm curious, what's going on in Garrett Riley's head is very complicated. But, excuse me, at the same time, that's how he gets ahead. That's his whole thing, is he thinks about things in ways other people don't. He sees patterns the way other people don't, which means that you – as his father figure, basically, you have to be able to think like Garrett Riley. And you don't, you know, that's got to be a bit of a challenge when you, you know, because I mean, you don't have no disrespect to TV writing. You don't have to think that far ahead in TV writing the way Garrett does, I think, in these plots.
You know, I am definitely a more of a math, science, economics person than your average TV writer slash thriller novelist. I like that stuff. You know, I'm reading now a book about prime numbers. I mean, like, okay, that's stupid, but I just find it really fascinating. And I just, there's something about looking at the world in that way. It's not patterns. I mean, I'm no Garrett Riley, and I'm not that good at all of that stuff, or I would make making my living as a mathematician. I'm clearly not. But I do find it utterly fascinating. And I find, like, the cross-section between math and personal behavior to be really interesting. Like, you know, just the idea that there are statistically people do certain things over and over and over again in their lives. That doesn't mean you're going to do that thing tomorrow or in 5 minutes, because we have free will and we can do whatever. But statistically, chances are you're going to do that same thing over and over again. Right. And I find that intersection, like, I don't know, I'm always interested in that. And other people find it so boring. I don't. I just, like, that's great. Like, I don't know. I can't imagine why everyone is not just totally wrapped up in that. That's, you know, I guess that's a clear sign of a fetish, right? But it's a fetish.
Could be. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I've had Garrett in the back of my head for the last couple months, in that, even before I read the sequel, in that what's happening in the world financial markets and the oil markets, which seems to be rocking the financial markets every day. I haven't read The Ascendant. It's been whatever it was, a year and a half ago, maybe longer, 2 years. I haven't read it in a while, but it seems to me that a lot of what you dealt with in that book in terms of market manipulation, resources, and all that kind of stuff, it feels a lot like what's going on right now between the Saudis and the Venezuelans and the Americans and the fracking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, in King of Fear too, like, so the sort of, for your audience, the backstory of Ascendant was that it's about the sort of invisible war between the United States and China, right? And there's all this cyber psychological economic manipulation and sort of battle going on between these two world powers. And in The King of Fear, it's much more about Europe and Eastern Europe and Russia. And the big idea is that somebody's trying to make a bank fail. There's somebody's trying to make there be a bank run. And that's, I did a lot of research on this and talked to economists and people in the markets, and they were all like, you know, the thing that nobody will ever talk about, but their real deepest, darkest fear is that a giant bank will go under. I mean, that's what, when we really talk about what happened in 2008, it wasn't just that the credits markets froze and that all these subprime mortgages went out. It was that big banks went kaplooey. And if enough big banks go kaplooey, like, the world kind of ends, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And right now, I just was watching the other day, or I was reading a newspaper article about how Deutsche Bank, the biggest bank in Germany, is under an incredible amount of stress. And they feel like, a lot of regulators feel like they are teetering on the verge of some really bad stuff. And if Deutsche Bank goes down, oh my God, that is not going to be fun. Right. I mean, it's not going to be fun for the United States, but it's really not going to be fun for Germany. So that'll be interesting. So yes, this stuff it's happening all the time. And that's the other thing I love writing about, is I love writing about stuff that's happening right now. I just, you know, I find it totally fascinating. I am a news junkie big time. So yes, the fact that you look back on The Ascendant and go, wow, that stuff really happened, that's like what I want. That is what I want the reader takeaway to be. Holy crap, how did he know that?
Well, so the first book was essentially boiled down to the U.S. and China, kind of cyber arm wrestling. And then the second book, kind of the same thing with the U.S. and Russia, basically. So where do you go from there? I mean, you're going to deal with Saudi Arabia next? I mean,
No, not Saudi Arabia. To me, you know, like, one of the things, when I was talking to the people at Homeland, one of the things they said was, so you really haven't dealt with the U.S. Muslim sort of contretemps, and I haven't, and for specifically because I feel like those are murky waters. I mean, obviously they are, you know, are there is a radical Islam issue going on between Islam and the West, but I feel like a lot of people are covering that ground, and there's a lot being said about it. And maybe you read this book. There's a book called I Am Pilgrim.
Oh yeah, he was on the show. Great, great guy,
and a really good book. But its view of Islam was, I gave me pause. Mm. You know, it's like it was really, I was uncomfortable with that.
Yeah,
and I just felt like, what is he saying about the world? What is that? I'm not sure I agree with that. So the Saudi thing, I've been staying away from. No, I actually feel like the next one I want to go is more internal. I actually want to talk about election fraud and the rigging of an American election.
Oh, that could never happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Never happen.
Totally impossible.
No big deal about voting, you know, two or three times in Chicago. Why would it be a problem?
Exactly. And when I told my publisher, they were like, well, can you get that out before the 2016 election?
Like, no.
That's not going to happen.
No. Well, that sounds very cool.
I mean, well, you know, got to get it written, but yes.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, if you – that's the – I was thinking part of the drawback in dealing with, you know, your big bads are China and Russia for the first two books. Well, unless there's a Martian invasion, you can't get much bigger. So
right,
I wondered,
right.
You know.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe my books just get smaller and smaller and smaller until it's just – it's a little love triangle at the end. There's no thriller in it whatsoever.
Yeah, just going to do the finish up with the Garrett Riley love novel.
Exactly, and he'll have a readership of 7.
Yeah. But he's such a romantic, that guy.
He is. He's so romantic. No, he's sexy. He's not romantic.
He's sexy. Well, the mind is a very sexy thing.
There you go. Which chicks really dig that. Oh, yeah. I've found that they go nuts over that.
Okay. yeah, we'll just let that one go. You know, one of the things I think I may have said before is I think the reason that the Riley stories go so fast, and I think it was the case here in King of Fear, is your TV and film background, is that – you know, you're used to not filling the pages. You're used to getting right down to what happens. There's the action, and there's the dialogue, and then you move on, and then scene, and then action and dialogue and scene.
Right.
You know, obviously these books have narrative to them, but I think the pacing works because you were used to working in a different medium.
Well, for sure. I mean, I totally cut my teeth in television. In a way, when I'm writing a book, I have to slow myself down. I have to take a breath, describe more, let the story, you know, sort of blossom a little bit more, because I always have the words of a showrunner in my head. I can remember him taking my script and he's, you know, editing it, and he's like, Jesus Christ, Chapman, do they pay you by the word? As he's like slashing word after word after word, you know, like. And you just, when you're a television writer, you're like, oh God, this is, you know, this is too much by a third. I have to write, just cut. And that is what you do. You know, the television's kind of like haiku. You know, it's very minimalist. And my publisher is always still going, you know, this can be longer. We can have more pages. And to me, when she first said that to me, I was really horrified. Like, you want this to be bigger, longer? No, there's a limit. There's a rule. Isn't there a rule about how long a book can be? It's like, no, there's no rules.
No rules.
It doesn't work like that. So I'm used to rules. But yeah. Yes, and the very, very first impetus of writing a book had been, sometimes you write these scripts that you love and people love reading, but they don't make them. And, you know, I think you're lucky if one out of every 5 or one out of every 10 scripts actually sees, like, the screen or the small screen. And those other 9, you love them, and they're put together so lovingly and they're, you know, carefully. And you want to take that skill and that compelling sort of plot and show it to the world. And so then I was like, oh, well, I should do that as a book, because then I don't have to worry about somebody like saying they're going to spend $30 million to actually make the thing. You know, it's much lower stakes.
It must drive you crazy, too, in that you write a script, and when it doesn't get picked up and it doesn't get produced, you've written this thing, and I'm sure you take great pride in your work, as most people do, and it's just like – and plus, there's very few people who know how to read a script, per se, to get everything out of it. So it really can't go very far.
And the readership is very small. You have a readership of, like, 100 people because those are the executives. You know, I think one of the things that you have to keep in mind always as a screenwriter or as a TV writer is that what you're writing is not the finished product. You're never writing the finished product. That's not the point. The point is you're writing a blueprint for other people to build upon. And if you start taking the script as an example of the finished product, you're making a mistake. You're making it too important. I mean, the script is incredibly important, but how it's crafted, the words are kind of less important. It's, you know, other people are going to take those words and make them real. And you have to always be thinking about that, how that's going to work. And that's obviously one of the huge drawbacks of writing television. And one of the great things about writing novels is it's the finished product. The book is there. There it is. It's like, and people can, you know, read it and understand it as you wrote it. There's no intermediary between, and I love that. That's fantastic.
Of course, just yesterday it was announced that the Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, which is on Broadway, or I guess it's the West End, it's coming out in 2 months as a book because people, you know. So, I mean, she didn't even have to flesh it out. They're just going to produce it as a book, and you know it's going to sell 10 million copies.
I mean, she signs a napkin, it sells 10 million copies. Yeah, and that's an example of, or she is an example of, sort of how the, you know, cross media, I mean, like, all these different platforms, they all kind of blend into one, right? It's like, is it a book? Is it a television show? What's the difference between, like, a book read on audio? Like, there's an audiobook of King of Fear, and I always point, as this is an example, I'm like, if you're listening to the audiobook of King of Fear, are you reading a novel? No. Is it a novel? Not exactly. It's somebody telling you a story over your headset. I mean, it's like, that's a different experience. You're not, you know, there's a way in which when you're reading a book and you're reading the actual words on the page and they are in your head, that's a different, you know, the voice of the author is in your head. You are interpreting it entirely in your own way. There's this very intimate link between author and reader. And if somebody reads it to you, it's different. It's just a slightly different experience. So, I don't know. My geek theory is just that all these different mediums are blending. Like, and that's why you get people like me who write television, but also books, and, you know, because they are kind of coming together. It's like the, and now I'm going to totally geek out on you, Bob, so sorry, but like those Netflix shows like House of Cards or Jennifer Jones, Jessica Jones, sorry.
Jessica.
Jennifer, I think Jennifer Jones is somebody else.
Actress.
Yeah. They are, like, Netflix thinks of them as extended movies, right? They drop them all at the same time.
Right.
And you watch them like you read a book or like you watch a movie. So it's different. So they're not really television shows. They're, like, kind of television shows. I don't know. I find that, like, that kind of the future is weird and cool to me.
That's like HBO used to have the ads that said, it's not TV, it's HBO.
Right.
It's not TV, it's Netflix. It's, yeah.
Yeah, totally, totally. It's not HBO, it's full frontal nudity.
I'm all for that. Exactly. Jessica Jones, I mean, that or the Daredevil, it's like this entirely, it's immersion television because you really do lose yourself. And you know, it just keeps playing. If you don't pick up your remote control, it really is like a long movie because it'll play 12 hours. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and talk about like living in a universe, right? Like you're living in that Marvel universe, and there's all these little hints to other Marvel ideas and comics and people and stuff, and like they take that very seriously. They really they salt that kind of stuff into the show.
Oh, plus, I'm getting off topic here, but I got to say, in my wife's case, who had never read a Marvel comic in her life, You know, she got into the movies, but then it took months to get her to commit to the Daredevil. And then suddenly, every night after work, she had to come home and watch Daredevil. And Jessica Jones right. was the same thing. And she says, well, who's this guy? What's this Luke Cage? And I'm like, right. I said, sweet Christmas, dear. You got to learn about him. And you know.
Pause. Hold on. Let me tell you.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is a different experience. So tell me this. So I've now read both of your novels. Eager to get to the next one. I'm that guy who'll be waiting, you know, at the mailbox or at the bookstore for the next Drew Chapman book.
Thank God.
You'll always have me. I'm loyal that way. But how would it be different if I did pick up a Drew Chapman TV or film script? How would I find the wordsmithing different?
If you were to, instead of seeing a show that I've written, actually just read the script?
Yeah, if I could lay my hands on a Drew Chapman script.
That's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that question before. I think you would I teach writing classes every once in a while, and right now I'm teaching a TV writing class. And the thing that I try to explain to prospective screenwriters, specifically TV writers, is that you think that you are watching this show wherein the voice is the voice of the character or this other character, the actor, the director. But it all comes back to the voice of the writer. And the writer has to, like, even if the show that you're watching is incredibly bland and bad, that original script most probably had a very distinct voice that was the voice of that particular creator. It's not the voice of the staff writers who write the episodes afterwards, but that creator, that Vince Gilligan, that Matt Wiener, who has a very specific way of having their characters talk and has very specific things that happen and obsessions, you know, like the fetishes of Vince Gilligan are different than the fetishes of Drew Chapman. And his obsessions are different than you know, Matt Wiener's and or Aaron Sorkin's or help me, because I'm trying to find a female creator right now, and it's
Tara Butters and Michelle Fazekas.
There we go, those guys, Butters and Fazekas. So I think you would, if in reading it, the actual words, you wouldn't say, oh yeah, that sentence was a Drew Chapman sentence, but you might say after reading a bunch of scenes, I get the voice that is his in particular. I get what he gets, you know, worked up about and what his characters get worked up about. So I think that's where you'd find it. But in truth, you know, the problem with television shows, if you're not, I don't want to like pick on those girls who I think are great, but they write certain network shows that get filtered all the time before. They write a script and filter, and then it goes onto the air. Whereas somebody like Vince Gilligan, he's writing cable show. He probably just writes a script and everybody goes, oh, okay, we'll just shoot it like it is. So his voice is unfiltered in a way that and so my voice on television gets more filtered. I'm not Vince Gilligan. I don't have that kind of power. I don't have that kind of prestige. And so they, you know, people tweak you, make you do it. So maybe sometimes the voice isn't quite as pure. Mm.
I was thinking about it last night. It's a sitcom, actually. We watched The Grinder with Rob Lowe and oh gosh, I can't think of the kid from Wonder Years. Anyway, so we watch it, and every other week it's fall down funny, but the other weeks it's so apparent that someone else has written it.
Right.
That my wife says, why are we watching this show? I said, because last week it was the other writer. Because we're not checking the credits. We're not that
right.
attentive to it. But it's clear from the tone and the style that it's a different, you know.
That can be for sure. And you can definitely see that. Sometimes, like, a show that I watch all the time, Game of Thrones, when Benioff and whatever the other guy's name is write the episode, it's usually a step above when other people are writing the episodes. But I also think that for a show like The Grinder, where they're doing like 22, 23 episodes a year, it's just hard to be really funny 22, 23 straight episodes. And like, you kind of, it's, again, to go to patterns, right? You kind of revert to the mean. It's like the law of large numbers. You just, you go above and then you crash below, and you above and crash below. And there's no like flat, like it's this funny all the way through. That just doesn't happen. It's, you know, it's still an art. And I think it goes for all television shows. Look, it goes for Lee Child writing, you know, Jack Reacher novels. Like, if you're going to write with some of this, not so good. And like, that's kind of the game. It's so rare where you see a show or a series of books where every single one is just spectacular. And I feel like sometimes you do, like, a show will have a run, like, for a year. That year will just be like, you know, to me, like, Seinfeld had, like, 2 years where, like, almost every episode was side-splittingly hysterical.
They're and, spectacular.
Like, so on point. Like, they just, yeah, they were spectacular. Just so on point, too, like, thematic and about stuff and surprising, and like you're like, wow, this is really, really good. But before that and after that, you know, right. they came and went.
Yeah, it's not as consistent.
Not as consistent. Nobody can be that consistent, and that's why series jump the shark, right? That's why they, because you just run out of stuff to say. And like, okay, let's have them water ski.
Right. Let's talk. We were watching Arrow last night. We watch a lot of superhero shows in our house.
You clearly do.
We do. And I was thinking, I didn't say this to my wife, but I was thinking, what will be the moment when this show jumps the shark? Like right now, it's pretty compelling. It's good stuff. It's, you know, it's very good week after week. Mark Guggenheim is the showrunner, and
right.
I have a preference there. He's been on this show twice talking about it. I like him. But there's going to come a moment when he'll move on. There'll be another writer, and it'll jump the shark. And I think, well, what will that be? You know, I don't know.
It's hard. And like, you know, now we're getting into the nitty gritty of it, and I'm sure you've spoken to other TV writers about this, but like, there are some kinds of shows like CSI or NCIS where they are pretty flat because there's just not a lot of variation. It's always the same thing. And honestly, no offense to those shows, I don't watch them. I can't. Like, they're just uninteresting to me. They're not about like human emotion. They're not about real people. They're about just this mystery. What is this mystery? And so they can, you know, and that show's gone on for God knows how many years, just endlessly. And it's the same. It's the same over and over and over.
And he's moved on from Law and Order. Well, I was thinking Dick Wolf. Years and hundreds and thousands, maybe, episodes of the Law and Order series, and that's wound down. And now it's 16 Chicago Med, Fire, Law, you know. And
are those Dick Wolf shows?
Yeah, they're all Dick Wolf shows.
God, he is just – he must be so wealthy.
Insane, right?
Totally insane. There was a time I remember reading some article that said, like, if you looked at televisions all over the world in any 24-hour span, there was always a Dick Wolf show on somewhere in the world.
Well, and this is too far afield, but if you haven't read it, maybe you have. The Hollywood Reporter a few months ago did a story about his pending divorce, and it's all tied up in the number of shows and the amount of income. But I want to move on from this, but I got to point one more thing out. If you haven't watched The Grindr, or if you've watched The Grindr, or if anybody watching this watches The Grindr, here's how you know it's going to be a good episode, and here's how you know it's not going to be a good episode.
Okay.
At the beginning of the show, most of the good episodes start with the family sitting around the TV and watching the TV show inside of the TV show, which is The Grindr, featuring Rob Lowe as this TV character, the Grindr, who's a TV lawyer. When they sit in front of the TV and they have inside jokes about being on TV and what it takes to make a show a hit and how they get past mid-season and all that kind of stuff, when those are funny, you know it's going to be a good episode, because the other episodes either don't have the family in front of the TV talking, making in jokes, and they're not funny. And that's how we know. We know right from the beginning it's going to be a funny one or it's not.
Linda, that's perfect. You can just
tune
it
out.
Off.
Yep.
Just turn it off. That, switch channels.
We'll be coming to that. Now we've had enough episodes. Now we know what to watch. All right.
Exactly.
So enough Grindr. tell me about what are you working on in TV now? Obviously you're up for this Homeland thing, which
I don't think that's going to happen. I was just on this. I did the second season of Legends for TNT, the Sean Bean show. I was not the showrunner. I was just a writer on staff. This guy named Ken Biller was the showrunner. A good guy. Good, done a million television shows. You should have him on your show someday. He did a lot of Star Trek. So we did a season of that, but honestly it didn't get great ratings, and it's not coming back for a third season. So it was a reboot. There was a first season. The first season did terrible. Everybody got fired. They hired a new team. I was part of the new team. We rebooted the whole thing. I thought it was much better qualitatively. but it still just didn't get an audience. TNT is kind of going through a shift of what kind of shows they are making, and we were caught sort of in a little bit in the transition. So they were very much the Rizzoli and Isles network, and now they're trying to be a little edgier, a little weirder, and so we moved them in that direction, but didn't quite nail it for them. So I did that, and then I'm writing a pilot for Amazon, actually, for Amazon Television, Amazon Studios, that I'm rewriting and going to hand in, and that is it is, how do I describe it? It is about a single mom living in Denver who becomes a revolutionary. She becomes the Che Guevara of the United States, and it's not an entirely serious show, tonally not unlike maybe Fargo. So definitely out there. And I think I'm just about to start doing another show. We're going to talk about it. I can't I can't divulge quite yet, but there's a star involved, and it would be a spy show.
Oh, so a new, so it'd be something new.
Yes, entirely something new, and I seem to be the spy show guy these days. So, you know, that's my niche.
Do you think that the books, well, the Ascendant anyway, since King of Fear is just out, do you think that that has changed perception, or do the TV people not read?
No, the TV people do read, or they have people read for them.
There you go. I'm sorry. Yes.
You know, I think it sort of hammered home, like, that this is what I do. I do thrillers, and I do spy thrillers, and it's weird, like, you kind of don't want to be pigeonholed, and yet at the same time, I really like spy thrillers, and the more I know about the inner workings of, like, the CIA and the FBI and the KGB, the more I want to write about it. Mm. So, like, you kind of pigeonhole yourself. I mean, you know, on all of these shows, we always get, like, advisors and consultants, and they're real CIA agents or ex-FBI agents, and I just love talking to them. It's like so interesting to hear about their exploits and the crazy crap that they did, and you know, and so you want to tell more of those stories. So yeah, I guess I'm the spy guy. That's my thing.
Not a bad thing to be.
Yeah, as long as you can keep working, then you're okay. So at least I'm something.
Well, that's true. It better be something than to be nothing.
Than nothing, exactly. Yeah. Right, the unemployed guy.
Yeah, you do not want that. It's hard enough because, I mean, you're free agent from season to season.
Absolutely.
You know.
Until I get that overwhelmingly huge smash hit, Bob, then I will not be a free agent.
Well, I hope you won't forget us then.
I will totally forget you.
Why else would you want to have a big hit so you
exactly.
could forget all these people?
I'll be like Bob calling, no, not no, today. No,
don't know anyone named Bob unless it's Bob Iger.
Exactly.
So let's wrap up with this. Has the meeting of the media happened yet? Has anyone purchased an option on the Garrett Riley character?
So yes. So after The Ascendant, actually before The Ascendant even came out, Fox bought the rights to that book, and I wrote a pilot for them for the series, which we did not make. It never went to series for various reasons. I think there were competing projects that were sort of similar, but the rights for the character in the book reverted back to me, and now we are. And I have to admit that when I was writing the TV show for the book, it was a very strange experience because I was rewriting my own book to turn into a television show, and I was changing the characters, and I was doing it of my own free will. I was like, well, that doesn't really work for as a TV show, and that doesn't really work. I need to change this and that. And it was so odd, and it began to – I was at the same time I was writing book two, and it began to like affect the way I was writing book two and like change the characters. And so I didn't like that. It was really problematic for me, and I thought – okay, I need to like stop, do one, then do the other, which I did. And I need to go back to sort of first principles in writing the book and really have it be a book. I wanted to be separate and a book. And then it was, and it was fine. And I wasn't going to even think about selling it as a television show or a movie. But people are beginning to knock on the door. Like, hey, we like this book and we were interested. And so we'll see. I don't know. I'm of, and this is, I, totally, honestly, I'm of two minds. I want it to be a book. Like, I want it to live as a book, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm talking about all the way these mediums are combining them. And I'm like, no, I want it to be this other thing, this pure thing, because I like it. And that's why I wrote it. And if you make it a television show, then it becomes this very, very different thing. So I don't know. On the other hand, if somebody comes to me with a lot of money, I'm just going to sell it because that's the kind of person I am.
I'd do the same.
And exactly.
I mean, I would love
there
to
see. There is a word for that.
Sell out? What are we thinking?
I was thinking more with a W, the whore word.
Oh, but, the whore word. Well, you're in you work out of Hollywood sometimes, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I could easily see it as a cable or a Netflix, Amazon type of series where you could do 12, 13, 10, I guess it'd be 10 or 12 episodes, and you could have that extended film type of thing. I don't think it would hold up as, you know, the plot of the week. It's too complicated.
Yeah. I think you could take the – first of all, I think King of Fear would work more as a television show than the first one did, than The Ascendant. I think that it's more suited, and I think you'd have to have it be – the book would have to be like five or six episodes pulled from the book and then adding plot to it too. So you could run the book as an entire season. Hmm. And that is what I want to do. Hmm. I think.
All right, so last question. Yes. I know I said that was the last question, but I lied.
It's always, that's what's so happening.
This is the last question, and this is the uncomfortable question.
Uh-oh.
The King of Fear, the complete saga. You got to explain that to me. I thought maybe after I read it, it would make sense. I still don't understand.
You had to
it.
Ask.
People are going to ask.
Okay, so what? It's a long story. So sit back. After I wrote the first book, my publisher came to me and said, "Hey, we'd like to release your next book in segments as a serialized book. You're a television writer. You have sort of this way of writing sort of cliffhangery endings of chapters. How about you write it in segments and we release it as a serialized book?" I was like, well, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Okay, I could do that. And so I wrote it in three parts, with each part to be sort of 150 pages or so, with a cliffhangery ending, and then as self-contained, but all part of the same book. So online, actually, you can get the book now online in three parts. It's like $2.99, $2.99, $2.99 for each part as an ebook. Mm. And then the actual physical book now comes out in like next week on the 16th of February. And so that's why it's the complete saga, because it's all the sections put together. If you just bought it at a bookstore, you'd be like, is this about Vikings? It's a saga. Is it Icelandic? I don't know. It's a little confusing, I will admit. I've had moments of angst about it, but now I am accepting my fate, and you'll just have to look at that cover and go, what the hell is this guy talking about?
At least
I still
want to
read the book. Yeah, exactly. Well, I was thinking about just going to every bookstore with a Sharpie and every book and take it out, but that's a little crazy.
It's one of those inside baseball things where it probably made sense that the publisher, because they do so many things, and like, oh, well, this is different, so we have to say this about it. But to the average reader, it's going to be like, they're just not
going to.
It would probably just won't even register. It's like some books in recent years, they've taken the title and they've written a novel underneath real small.
Oh, they do it all the time.
Yeah, and that's more common
now. Thriller.
Now.
A thriller, yeah. A mystery, yeah.
I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird did not say a novel.
But it would have sold more, had it.
Because it wasn't a guide to killing a mockingbird.
Exactly. Yeah. It was Audubon's. that's the backstory of it, and I think it makes sense, and if it doesn't, just read the book anyway, and next one won't have that, I swear.
No, well, read the book anyway, folks. I got to say.
There you go. That's the final answer.
And here's the important part, folks. You can find both, one and two, both of Drew Chapman's Garrett Riley novels, The Ascendant, the first one, and the new one, The King of Fear, The Complete Saga, in great bookstores. You know, what am I going to do?
Yeah, I had to do it.
I got to get the promo in, and I got to get it the right way, right? But you can get them in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order them right now at a great price, MrMedia.com. If you are watching on MrMedia.com, just below the video, you'll see the covers to the books. You can click on them right now. And my understanding is that Amazon now delivers via drone, so you can have them in about 30 minutes or less. You might even be able to get them faster than you can get a pizza. But they won't be free if they're longer than 30 minutes. On the other hand, you know, you might be able to – it might take a day or two. So don't hold me to that. Drew, website is drewchapman.com?
Drew Chapman author.
Author.
Drewchapmanauthor.com.
Not to be confused with Drew Chapman, the guy who picks up your trash on Tuesdays.
I think he's an accountant, and I think he lives in Milwaukee, and he has that website. So.
Okay. So you've researched this, apparently.
Yeah, there's a dude.
And are you doing any social media? Is there anywhere people can interact with
you? Yeah, there's a Drew Chapman on Twitter, and there's a Facebook page to like Drew Chapman. It's all out there. You know, or just my website. You go to drewchapmanauthor.com, and it's all sort of listed there. You can find it.
Very cool.
Although I have to admit, the social media stuff is hard for me. You got to keep doing it, but oof.
You do. You really do. It's the only way to, you know, separate yourself from everybody these days.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of promotion.
All right. Well, Drew Chapman, this is your second time on the show. I feel like you've been here more because you seem like a very comfortable guy for us to have on. Look forward to having you back. Maybe sometime we can have you come on and talk about a TV show.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of humble public servants who wouldn't dream of disobeying the boss in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. We'll get through this. You will be able to go back to something constructive, I promise.
This is the most constructive thing I'll do all day.